Welcome to the Chat Room, the podcast on humanitarian action by the Center for Humanitarian Action in Berlin. Today, CHAR Director Ralf Südhoff welcomes the head and representative of OCHA in Geneva, Ramesh Rajasingham, to the Chat Room.
Let's welcome Ramesh Rajasingham. Thank you so much for taking the time and many thanks for being with us in the chat room, as well as last days at our CHAR 25 conference on contested aid. Ramesh, we'd like to discuss today a humanitarian system and crisis, the official end of US aid just a few days ago, and where we stand with a much needed and much debated humanitarian reform after the long-awaited meeting of the so-called Interagency Steering Committee, a coordination body mainly of UN agencies and some Red Cross and INGO participation. And Ramesh, many say these are not only challenging but unprecedented times of disruption and overall crisis of humanitarian aid itself. Against this backdrop and your great experience, you are from Sri Lanka. You are today the head and representative of UN OCHA in Geneva. You served as deputy emergency relief coordinator. You've been operative in crises like Syria, Palestine, Afghanistan, Sudan. Against this backdrop, what's the big deal? Since you started, one might say humanitarian funding has been growing by about 20 times. Now it might drop by about a third. So what's the big deal? Why do we all talk about a crisis?
First of all, Ralf, thank you very much for having me on board. And it was also a pleasure to join you at your annual conference and to meet such a distinguished group of colleagues there as well. And I think you raised a really good question. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of focus on this, but you're really going to the root of the issue. We've seen humanitarian needs increase, I would say, exponentially over the last few years. And this comes mainly out of conflict. Conflict is a major driver of these needs. But it's also natural disasters. And then more recently and increasingly, we're also seeing the collapse of social safety nets in many countries, including in middle-income countries, who don't necessarily have access to development financing. And as a result, some of the indicators there are extremely worrying. They become humanitarian indicators in terms of vulnerability. So we've also had to try and cover some of those needs in our work. As a result, at the end of last year, we launched a global humanitarian overview, which is our overall response plan for global humanitarian crises, requesting about $44 billion to target the needs, and these are really prioritized needs, of 180 million people caught in crises, in humanitarian crises. And this ranges from Colombia and Haiti in the West, all the way to Myanmar, going through many countries in Africa and Middle East, where the largest numbers of vulnerable people are. So I think, and as those needs grew, so did, to be honest, so did donor funding. But donor funding did not keep up with the sort of accelerated needs. And as a result, the gap between the funding and the needs grew significantly. And before this current funding crisis that we are facing today in 2025, last year and the previous year, 2022 and 2023 and 2024, I think we face some of the largest gaps in terms of needs versus funding. So we were already in a significant crisis in terms of our response, ability to respond effectively to all those needs before this funding crisis. And now, as you mentioned, and that has deepened dramatically in the first few months of this year. The U.S. spend on last year's humanitarian budget or in last year's humanitarian response or action was 43%. So, and the next biggest donor was contributed 11%. So the U.S. was a huge leader for us in the humanitarian action. They were significant in the sense that their contributions and the action that resulted out of that saved thousands of lives, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. Now we've lost that, and so we've had, but it's not just the U.S. Many countries, including Germany, where you are, many of our traditional big donors, they've also had to reduce their aid budgets, and some of that money is going towards defense budgets and other budgets in those nations, in those capitals. And so we feel we've had to hyper prioritize these needs. So the exercise that we've just been through in the last few weeks is a hyper-prioritization of that initial response guide that I spoke to at the beginning. So when I said that we wanted to target the needs of 180 million people at the beginning of this year, knowing that there will not be the resources for that, we've further prioritized it to about 114 million people who we feel are at really the highest priority and need assistance immediately. So we're now, the hyper-prioritized response plan is for 115 million people, 115. And we're asking for about $29 billion to respond to that. So we've also dropped the ask. That is obviously in light of the funding crisis, but also the need to for humanitarians to actually also really prioritize their work. And as I mentioned before, we've become stretched in terms of our response. And I think even before this whole funding crisis, when Tom Fletcher, our Rwanda Secretary General and the Emergency Relief Coordinator, came on board, he had already asked Jan Egeland, the head of NRC, and the Archer Deputy, Joyce Msuya, to do a rapid sort of dramatic look into how we can have efficiencies in the organization and in the system to address this. Now, obviously, the funding crisis came a couple of months after that, so the work that was done there has really contributed to the work we have here now. So we're going through what we call a humanitarian reset now, and that reset is very much linked to that hyper-prioritized plan that I spoke to.
Many thanks for providing such a comprehensive picture on the financial challenges. At the same time, there was also a lot of talk that it goes about a growing financial gap. That might be also a crisis of the humanitarian values and of the legitimacy of the whole humanitarian system. Would you second that?
I think, so if I can understand the question right, our legitimacy, I think, is not so much in question. Obviously, you will definitely find actors who will question it, and you know it's a free world. But we have, over the last, since I guess the early 1990s, built a system that we feel is working in such extraordinary situations where you don't necessarily have all the norms and infrastructure that you would in a normal situation. You know, we've managed to deliver an enormous amount of assistance to people who have no other access to assistance. They're caught up in the worst situation. So I don't think it's so much the legitimacy of our work, but I think there's been a drop in support for multilateralism, a significant drop. And as you know, the humanitarian system depends on that multilateral nature of member states and donors. So that has dropped. And I think the confidence in the multilateral system has also dropped as a result. And then one of the symptoms of that obviously impacts humanitarian action. The other thing that I think, just very quickly on this, is that we've had a huge questioning of the rules-based system. The rules-based system, which basically provided the foundation for our work, is under attack, as is international humanitarian law. So those two elements have made our life much more dangerous on the ground.
Many thanks for relating it to the broader context of a rules-based system and a lot of talk about the crisis of multilateralism. If one relates this in more detail into the challenges of the humanitarian system and its way of working, kicking it off with, you mentioned humanitarian law, which there's a great deal of disrespect, not only in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Sudan, etc., and many see it as disrespect in new dimensions. There was a lot of talk about disrespect for the key idea of humanitarian principles to be the one aid sector which is impartial and neutral and not supposed to be politicized, geopolitical, security-driven, etc. Would you see that there's at least a new pressures in new dimensions on this front and really getting to the heart of what humanitarian aid is all about?
Yes, maybe I'll take it from the position of the humanitarian reset, which the Interagency Standing Committee, which, as you know, is the coordinating body for all the UN humanitarian agencies and the NGOs that work in crisis countries. So the humanitarian reset, I think, really points very much to that. It's how do we take a good look internally at ourselves, at our work, and better define it. Because as I mentioned, it's become perhaps we've overextended ourselves in many situations because we were the only actor there. So I think to go back to the roots of humanitarian action, which is, you know, rapid assistance, basic assistance, life-saving assistance to populations caught in emergencies and disasters who have little to no access to that assistance from anyone else. So I think the reset is really, that's what we're going back to. And there are three elements to the reset that we're focusing on. One is, in this system, how can we provide the best possible assistance to the most affected people with the resources we have? So resources obviously plays a huge part in this. Now, to do that, secondly, to do that, how do we reimagine the system in light of all the developments that has happened recently, changing landscapes, the loss of, the loss of innocence for humanitarian neutrality, etc. How do we reimagine the system so that we can regain that and recover that and be able to provide that, deliver that assistance? And thirdly, and I think this is the most important one, is the humanitarian enterprise is a massive one. It's billions of dollars. But how do we, in that enterprise, in that environment, how do we devolve the power that we have at headquarters to leadership in the field and have them drive it and not necessarily approach it with guidance and policies developed at headquarters, but they identify what's the most effective way to provide urgent life-saving assistance to the most affected people in their context, in their country. And that could change vastly from, let's say, from Colombia to the Democratic Republic of the Congo to Myanmar to Gaza. It could change dramatically depending on the context. So by transferring the power to the local leadership will be more effective. And the one element of that is that power has to be, we need a much stronger leadership role delivered to local actors. In other words, local actors to have a much bigger say in how we assist those populations, because they are the ones, obviously, who provide sustainability, they'll provide accountability, and they know best what their communities need as well. So those are three elements. I would say the ERC has, and I can quote him, the four Ds. How do we define the work that we're doing? And that, I think, relates very much to the hyper-prioritization we've done. How do we deliver it in the most effective way with the resources we have? How do we devolve the power to the local leadership of the humanitarian community and local actors? And finally, and most importantly, how do we defend international humanitarian principles, international humanitarian law, to make sure that, you know, those populations, first and foremost, can be protected, but also that the aid workers themselves are not targeted, as increasingly they have been. We've had the worst attacks on aid workers of the last 2 years. We've lost over 400 aid workers last year alone.
And if we take these areas you outlined so transparently and look now into, for example, the results of the much-awaited latest meeting of the Interagency Steering Committee you mentioned already a few days ago, a couple of donors, 21 donors, have shared a letter on their expectations and indicating in, of course, diplomatic language what they ask for and where they apparently call for much more response, especially by the big UN agencies you are coordinating only. I mean, if I may quote just a few points, Germany and Sweden, as co-leaders of this letter by 21 governments, have put on the table. One, avoid turf battles, competition and mandate-driven fragmentation. Establish direct reporting lines and accountability between the resident coordinators, the UNITAN coordinators, in a crisis like you've been one in the Syria context, for example, and make country directors of humanitarian UN agencies report to them on funds and programs, etc. Establish a drastically simplified and more agile humanitarian program cycle, which firmly places people, needs and protection at the center, including in the letter that donors will hold agencies accountable for engagement on this. How would you read this letter? Is it a fair thing to say that especially the leading, also European donor governments, really ask the big UN agencies, the implementers, WFP, UNICEF, UNHCR, to move faster and to give up more autonomy?
Oh, I think, first of all, I think it's enormously appreciated. The attention and the strategic engagement we have with donors is hugely appreciated, either because they understand our work, and they've been strong supporters of our work. And this dialogue is super important. You know, if you want to have a humanitarian system that is agile, as they mentioned, that meets the needs of that current environment as well. So support is, and I think they've laid out some very clear issues in the humanitarian response on the humanitarian community that we know that we've had to address. And this goes also back to that document that I mentioned earlier that Tom Fletcher had asked Jan Egeland and Joyce Msuya to do, to look at those efficiencies. And it was really addressing many of those things that the donors mentioned even before this financial crisis, and that is to stop competition, to have avoid duplication, to have sort of overriding coordination, et cetera. So I think definitely the letter is appreciated. Now, in terms of the work, I think the reset addresses much of this, and this is where we would really want to see strong donor support, because the reset is not just a humanitarian reset for the implementing partners. It's not a humanitarian reset for OCHA, for the UN agencies, for the NGOs. It's a reset for the community that supports humanitarian action, and that includes very much the donors, it includes local actors, and it will include also those governments, we know, where you have this crisis. So, as you mentioned, the IAC principles met on the 17th of June, just a few weeks back, and the principles agreed to further empower the humanitarian country teams led by the humanitarian coordinator to act as a strategic, a unified crisis platforms with UN and NGO representatives, mutually accountable to the humanitarian coordinator and local communities as well as the agency. So that much more cohesive response, context-driven response was very clearly agreed to by the agencies at the meeting. And in relation to the sort of competition and overriding coordination, they've also agreed to streamline the clusters. And as you know, the clusters, this has been the major vehicle for providing assistance to affected populations since 2007. So streamlining clusters, reducing their number, making sure that you only activate clusters that you need in the local context and not have every cluster create a capacity on the ground. Pooling of resources, sharing services, common services by default is also going to be another critical theme that we'll be looking at. So that's things like back office support functions, procurement, supply chains, logistics, information management, because data is and will be increasingly important in our work. And they also saw that there's much more room for integrating services in relation to needs assessment, information management, and risk management, because that's going to be a key concern going forward in these crisis countries.
Nice.
And we will also be looking to, how do we support coordination in a way that we reduce process? Because what we hear continuously from colleagues in the field is that the burden of process placed upon them also impacts the ability to do work. So I think, yes, I would say the reset has, I think, brought us to a point where the IAC and the donors have, a very common approach to these things. But we need everyone to join in this endeavor to make sure it's a successful reset.
And what gives you hope it might succeed this time? I mean, talking to local actors, talking to colleagues from NIR, for example, our last podcast ahead of this one has been with Hiba Kalfan, the CEO of NIR, raising major concerns that this could be a process where local voices are not participating. Once again, not heard, and a lot of promises made already 2016 at the World Humanitarian Summit once again might be ignored at the end of the day, because the big players would need to give up power, and who's ready to do this in such a process? What could you share with them? What gives you hope that this time the outcome could be different and power is really shifted?
I think, to be honest, it is a first of all, this is an imperative. Given the magnitude and the severity of the funding cuts we face, and the massive needs that we also face and that we need to respond to, there is no other way to do this where you can have an effective humanitarian operation. The cookie-cutter approach does not adequately provide the same sort of effective assistance that these people need. So it's an imperative. And, colleagues in OCHA from our boss, Tom Fletcher, to everyone working in OCHA, we've been in constant contact with the NGOs, with the local actors, NEAR, NIR, it's a local NGO consortium, trying to understand how we can best do this. The challenges are enormous, of course, and there's an issue of, transfer power or try to empower local actors in this situation where they have no access to resources. There are challenges, and we need to address them. But I think we are now at a point where everyone understands this. And in the recent IASC principles meeting, as I mentioned, they all agreed to come in under the reset, behind the reset. That has not always been the case in the past, right? There's been lip service paid to some of these issues, but that there's a clear need that, you know, we have to do this. And you may have seen the Emergency Relief Coordinator's summary of the meeting, where it mentions that there's a common agreement that there should be much more donor funding going directly to the country-based pool funds, because it's the country-based pool funds that have perhaps offered the best success rate since the World Humanitarian Summit for the to the targets that they were supposed to achieve. Country-based pool funds were supposed to transfer 25% of their overall funding to local actors. And now, if anything, we've gone way beyond that. I think it's over 40%. And OCHA's promise and pledge is to ensure that there's at least 70% of country-based pool funds going to local actors. That is so critical, because you cannot do this job without providing local actors resources. They have nowhere else to get resources from. And it's very clear from looking at our financial reports that local actors receive the least amount of funding bilaterally. So the real way to provide them is through these pool funds. But we need donors to step up and provide much more funding to country-based pool funds. It's a great tool. Why? Because it's at the governing body at the country level for each country-based pool fund includes donors, it includes local air organizations, it includes international NGOs, and it includes the UN. It's one of the best coordination mechanisms we have in the field. So you have a really good sense of where the money's going, who's going to spend it, and you'll be able to monitor it as well.
I mean, talking in practical terms, using the example of the country-based pooled funds, I mean, it's indeed fair to say, and much overlooked in the debate also by NGO colleagues, that the quota of local funding going from country-based pooled funds to local actors is the highest of any donors given, and much higher, for example, than related to some INGO pooled funds. But at the same time, there's a lot of criticism that participation is limited, that OCHA is coordinating the funds. It asks for more funding now to be prioritized to go via this channel. And there are concerns like for example, asking Hiba Kalfan in the mentioned podcast, well, wouldn't this be the way to go as long as we ensure that there is true participation by local actors in each country-based pooled fund and its decision-making bodies. She was very skeptical and saying, well, we know this experience of having a few more chairs for us on the table, but decisions are made in the same way. Can you understand that she comes from a mindset, and there's a concern that mindsets might not change by the international decision-makers, even if there is more funding and there is some reform in this structure versus a new one, versus a fully locally led one?
First of all, I think skepticism is good, and I think skepticism is important to keep us all honest, because it helps to address those gaps where, you know, perhaps we haven't necessarily seen it exist. And I think, you know, we've been in numerous discussions with local actors in the countries in which we work on this issue. And as I mentioned, that's why it's the coordination mechanism, which includes the representatives of the local actors and the local NGOs in the coordination mechanism, in the governing body. Each country-based pool fund has an advisory group at the country level, where the donors sitting in the countries, let's say, for example, in Ukraine, would include donors who are from Kyiv. It would include local Ukrainian NGOs. It would include the international NGOs and the UN. So the representation is there. We need to, you know, we need to make sure that it's a genuine representation of the local actors, and you know, that we have to keep pressing to make sure that they do speak for the overall group of local actors. So I think in that sense, yes, we can always improve the system, but I don't know of any other global endeavor, exercise, enterprise of pool funds that is coordinated at such a collective level, where you have the entire. You have this coordinating governing body, but you also have the humanitarian country team, which includes the international NGOs, the local actors, all the UN major agencies. Determining where the money goes, into which sectors or geographic areas it goes into, and the objective of those funds as well. So it's a locally driven fund. It's collective, and I think it's proved we have the due diligence measures to be able to manage the risk, because risk is a huge issue when it comes to transferring resources to actors in the field. So I think the system can always be strengthened, can always get stronger. And I think we're looking to find ways to do that in consultation with everyone. But I think for the time being, there is no other collective system that offers this broader coordination for that.
Touching maybe on a final point, you've just been to Germany, meeting a couple of decision makers in Berlin. Next week, Tom Fletcher is coming and kindly also hosting with us a session with civil society here at CHAR. What's your takeaway? How do you see Germany's role in this decisive period? I mean, it's now has just taken over the lead of the OCHA donor support group. It tries really to provide some leadership also via the letter I mentioned, co-led with Sweden. On the other hand, at the same time, right now plans are to cut Germany's return budget by more than half in 2025. How does this combine from your view? Is this maybe also a major issue? And providing leadership requires credibility, requires soft power. How would you comment on this overall German setup?
First of all, I think Germany as a strategic humanitarian donor over the last few years has been one of our premier leaders in terms of support for the humanitarian program, for humanitarian operations. So, and our partnership with Germany has been extremely strong, has been growing stronger and stronger over the last few years. We really welcome the engagement. I find Germany is present strategically in many, many humanitarian fora. And the engagement is hugely appreciated. I would say, don't let go of that leadership. It's so critical today with all the challenges we're facing. And the challenges, as I mentioned, are not just financial. It's this principled humanitarian action. It's international humanitarian law. It's a protection of aid workers. It's access. All these issues. Germany has been a huge supporter of us in these activities. So please don't give up that. And I'm convinced that Germany's not going to do that. But obviously, yes, I think, you know, the funding cut is going to be deeply felt, and it has a huge impact on the ground, as we have done what we can to hyper-prioritize a global humanitarian overview. So, you know, we need member states, and we need Germany to also corral member states and donors to step up and fund that response to the 114 million people who urgently need that life-saving assistance. Because if we don't, we could have a much, much bigger problem next year. And the next thing I would ask is also if Germany could help us empower those coordinators and the local aid actors to direct operations to save as many lives as they can. So we need to give them a strong mandate. We will simplify and streamline the coordination, but we need Germany to come in and encourage the system by incentivizing change through smart financing and flexible financing. And these were all commitments that came out of the World Humanitarian Summit. So we're looking forward to Germany's leadership as the chair of the OCHA Donor Support Group. Germany is a top donor, and they understand the environment in which we work. So we would very much appreciate it. And then again, Germany should remain a beacon for principled humanitarian action, defending humanitarian principles, the protection of civilians, the adherence to international humanitarian law. Increasingly, we're seeing an inconsistent approach to international law and humanitarian principles by member states who championed them before. I would say an inconsistent approach to them from conflict to conflict, from disaster to disaster. We need a much more consistent approach to this, because those principles, they are only valid as much as they are adhered to. And if there's any inconsistency, that will impact our neutrality and humanitarian operations in the future as well.
Maybe a final quick question on the practical side. What would you see as next milestones? What are the next steps after the June meeting? Even some experts seem to be a bit concerned that it's hard to tell what might be now in this process crucial next steps. And is there a risk that things might a bit fade away? What would you see? What are the next milestones, the next steps to take, meeting-wise, decision-wise, et cetera?
Well, I think a lot of the decisions have been made. And I think, you know, the humanitarian reset decision, you've seen the humanitarian reset, the 2.0 communication that was issued by the emergency relief coordinator. So the decisions are made. But that's not equally important is that there's been ownership of the decisions. So it's a collective decision that's been made by the IASC principles. Now we have to make sure that we look at the changes that are needed inside our organizations. And don't forget, our organizations have been through massive cuts. So we've had thousands of aid workers who've lost their jobs, both at headquarters and in the field. So now with this much smaller aid community, how do we take those changes and decisions that the principals have made and make sure that the system works? And the key to all this is to that a devolution of power to the humanitarian coordinator, the humanitarian country team, working hand in hand with local actors. So a lot of the action will now have to come from those colleagues in the field, and they would have to indicate to us what systemic changes they need to see at headquarters to make sure that that support to them is the most appropriate for that context and to give them the best chance to make the reset work. But that reset needs, as I mentioned before, it's a partnership with everyone, local actors, humanitarian implementing partners, humanitarian actors, and the donors and member states. So we need to have a much stronger advocacy with them. And also, to be honest, I think in closing, we need to be paying a little much more attention, I think, to ensuring that the governments where you have those crises take a much more proactive role in helping to open up access and to they themselves dedicating and committing much more of their resources to assisting affected populations.
Many thanks. Maybe only sharing a question from your boss, Tom Fletcher, just as a farewell question. In his last letter, Tom Fletcher raised the question, addressed it to all actors in the system. We all have to share power. What is the power your organization should share? Is there anything you would like to name OCHA would need to share, at least in the midterm, in this whole process?
I think if I can maybe turn the question around, it's us ensuring that the coordination is not just done with international actors and OCHA alone. It includes local actors. Make sure that local actors sit at that decision-making table and they share in the decision-making for what's needed, what's best needed, most appropriately needed for those communities which we all serve. I think that is, you know, bringing them on the board, making them, helping them make the decisions and taking our leadership from them. In the future, what I would like to see is that when we have a disaster or in a certain situation or an emergency, when we enter into the country, we don't create systems. We join the systems that exist, the indigenous systems that exist, and help with resources and perhaps a guide and other tools and instruments to empower them a little bit more, but have them take full leadership of this.
Thank you so much, Ramesh. Many thanks for taking the time to join our chat room and to talking to us. And all the best for your important work.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Ralph. It's been a real pleasure to do this. And I wish you a good meeting as well with Tom when he comes over there.
Thanks so much.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. You can find all relevant links to this session in the show notes. For example, to the recordings of the CHAR Conference 2025. If you have any feedback or suggestion, send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.